I think I have more questions now than when I did go into the military. I guess perhaps I haven't done a lot of thinking about it, and it's something that, well, I've gotten by not making any decisions on it that really counted. It was probably an easier thing for me to go into the military. I was not ready to go to jail for it at the time. And I felt very good about going in the military at the time. Not that I wouldn't have gotten out of it if I would have. I'd like to have this a real informal thing, so if you have any questions, just go ahead and jump up or yell or scream, and we don't have to run it like a military court-martial or anything. Okay. Oh, one of the reasons I thought this might be good for us to do, too, is that I know a lot of people have anti-military feelings, or, you know, that it's not a good thing. And I just think that you probably feel a lot like I do in many ways, that if you're going to be against something and work against something, perhaps it's good to know something about it. And that way I can share something for you. Okay. I grew up in a small Midwestern farming community, a rural church, rural Norwegian church. It was accepted that the men of the, or the boys would grow up and go in the military. My dad did not go in the military. He was too young for the, or he was too old, must have been too young for the World War II and too old for the Korean War, so he wasn't in on it. So we didn't have a military tradition in our family. My oldest brother, Jerry, he ended up volunteering for the draft when he was almost flunking out of college. Went to 2 years in the Army, served stateside the whole time. He got in on just a little bit of the Cuban crisis way back in 1962. But then he came back and finished his school, did real well. My second brother, Paul, he graduated from college and then went to OCS, which is the Navy officers training, down up on Newport, Rhode Island, I believe it is. And he was an officer on a destroyer for about 3-4 years, I guess it is, almost. He spent a lot of time in the Gulf of Tonkin during Vietnam. But he was never saw a lot of combat action. Then my sister came along. She didn't have to worry about it. And then I did. And then my younger brother, Rick, ended up not having to worry about it at all. So we got 3 out of 4 brothers all ended up. My parents talked about the military, not in good terms, but in acceptance terms. Like how sad it was that a young boy born to a family, you know, when he's born already he's committed for 2 years out of his life. This was during thinking about the draft coming up. There's really no way around it. I ended up going to college, getting a 2S deferment. It's probably, maybe some of this may come back in. A 2S deferment is going to school. As long as I was enrolled as a full-time student at an accredited university, I received a 2S deferment. That 2S deferment can run for 4 years consecutively. If I dropped out of school, I was eligible for the draft, eligible to be 1A. During my sophomore year of college came the time when they decided to have the draft lottery. Remember the night we were in our dorm rooms, and there was about 20 of us in this one dorm room listening to the radio. And one guy was writing it down. And they even had a pool going. Everybody threw in a dollar, and the guy that got the lowest number was supposed to get all the money. But
going away. But.
Yeah. My number was called 19, or no, the birth of my birthday, November 1st, was the 19th number called. So my draft number became 19. An interesting fact that continues that is the letter F for Swenson. After they drew all the numbers, they said, "Well, we got to divide up each day at the time." So they said, well, we'll draw the letters of the alphabet, and then your letter, your last name will also mean which order you're taking in on that day. The letter S was drawn 19, and I was 19 years old at the time. So I had 3 19s against me. It kind of forced me into the decision that, yeah, no, I can't, you know, get by with not going to the military. If I did drop out of school, I was going to get drafted immediately. So that first summer, ROTC, which is an officer's training thing that you go through college type thing all 4 years, has a program, a 2-year program. So I was at the University of Minnesota, and I went to them and I said, hey, you know, I'm going to I know something's going to happen as soon as I graduate from this place. And they said, well, we have this neat 2-year program. You go, you take our tests, and if you're qualified, you go to 6 months training in the summertime. And then during the next 2 years of college, you'll be, you know, in classes for once a week and keep your hair cut short and wear a uniform once a week or whatever. So I said, well, I better take these tests. So I took a battery of tests for them. They're very comprehensive tests. A lot on the order of, say, college entrance exams. So I took the AFQT, Air Force Officer Quality Test, or Qualifying Test, and also a Pilot Qualifying Test. And I ended up doing very well on both of those tests. And between the time I took the test and by the time I got the results, I walked back into this guy and I said, well, I decided I don't want to do it. And he goes, what? And he said, you did so well on tests, you got to do it. And I said, no, I just don't want to worry about it for the next 2 years. So my last 2 years of college were spent, I just didn't want to have the short hair, not that it was so long anyway, but to wear the uniform, just, you know, not have that happen. This was also during the time of some quite, I wouldn't say violent, but very active protests against the Vietnam War. This was like 1970 at the time. And I was usually an interested onlooker in a lot of these protests. And I remember like when the protests against the ROTC building at the University of Minnesota, and I was working at the Battle Museum of Natural History just across the hallway, or just across the street, and we all got up on the roof of it and watched this thousands and thousands of students around this ROTC building, and pretty soon rocks started throwing through the windows and things like that. But you knew that there was a very anti-ROTC on campus. Well, 2 years later, I was getting ready to graduate from college, and I had to, in fact, I took one class, independent study, which enabled me to graduate in my 4 years. I look at people today, and I'm not sure if I would have done it if I'd been given the chance, but people like, we'll say Doc, for instance, has taken a semester off from school, basically, this last semester. I would have not been able to do that because I would have been drafted immediately. So I had to complete my schooling in the 4 years. Well, I knew I was going to end up either being drafted. I was really facing a decision as soon as I graduated. If I didn't do something positive in one direction or other, I would get drafted as soon as I graduated from college. So I knew that if I got drafted, you're an enlisted person, you go into the Army, infantry, armor division, whatever. And I could see myself in Vietnam, you know, within a matter of months. I also, by this time, I had my private pilot's license, and I knew I loved to fly. And I said, well, if I'm going to do something, why not check into this? So I talked to the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. Skip the Marines. The Army guy says, hey, you know, a college degree, you can do much better just going down the street to these other guys. So I didn't hardly even talk to him. He just told me, hey, you look elsewhere because you're going to do a lot better. Talking to the Navy and the Air Force accepted, said, hey, you know, if you took these tests 2 years ago, they're probably still good. And it was an ideal time for me to take the tests. And they were good, so they got sent in. The Navy gave me all the test scores, gave me all the tests downtown Minneapolis one day. Those went over real well. The Air Force gave me a plane ticket from Minneapolis to fly to Grand Forks, North Dakota, to the Air Force base there to go through a pilot physical. Okay, all this time I have not gone through my draft board, and I've not gone through any pre-induction physical or any other physical that the draft board sets up for you. The results from my physical, Air Force pilot physical, came back, and I was qualified, medically qualified for pilot. So then this all gets sent into the Air Force headquarters. And at the same time, the Navy decided, well, they were going to fly me to Chicago for my physical. And I said, well, I know. And about this time, I get a letter from the Air Force saying, yes, you have been accepted for officer training and utilization in the pilot category. So I have not, at this point, I have not signed anything or committed myself one way or the other. So I decided, well, the Air Force came through first, and And I was probably leaning that way anyway. So I went through a delayed enlistment program, which meant that on May 1st of that year, I enlisted in the Air Force. It turned out to be a good deal, because then that turns your pay, you know, every so many years your pay increases, like time and grade and different things. And that time that I spent from May 1st to the middle of July when I actually went active duty was included as actual time for pay. So then I went down and, you know, it was the old federal building in Minneapolis, and we just stood in front of the flag and the oath of office type thing that I don't even remember exactly what the words are. Went back to university and played student for another 2 months. Okay, they gave me a class date of 5th or 17th of July was when I would be going active duty. My sister had been, an interesting fact, my sister had been in Holden Village just 10 years ago now, but I had already decided that, yes, I'm going to go to Holden Village before I go into the Air Force. So I had written to Warner, and I was accepted to come out here and said, yeah, you're welcome to come out. But then I was going to graduate on the 15th of June, and I was going to have to be in the Air Force on the 17th of July, and I had other things to take care of, so I wrote back to Holden Village and said, hey, I really can't make it this time, because it would have been a real quick trip out and back. So I skipped Holden Village just before the Air Force. It was kind of a traumatic time to get ready for the Air Force. I remember staying up late, packing and different things like that. It was raining that morning. I had to be down in Minneapolis at the old federal building at 5:30 a.m. So my parents drove me in. It was about like an hour drive, and get off there. And then you start to realize, what I later now realize, is you're really starting to get into the military. The first thing they did, even though I had been accepted, gone through a pilot physical, sent me through an induction physical. You know, everybody comes in. This is the one that a lot of people hear about. You're in one room, everybody takes their clothes off, and you start single line filing, you know, from room to room. Doctors checking different things, and it's one of those that if you walk through the room, you're probably okay. Then, you know, that took maybe a half hour to an hour, and then you sat around and waited again. And I waited until, our plane, then we did another oath of office. Then our plane left from Minneapolis International at 2:30 that afternoon. And then our parents, of course, would come see us again. So from 5:30 in the morning until 2:30 in the afternoon, basically we didn't do anything except fill out some forms and sit around and really do nothing. It's interesting that at that time, when I was in college before I got into the military and knew I was going to have to do it, people would approach me saying, well, there's ways to get out of it. People in my skydiving club would talk about things like, this one good friend of mine, he said he had a brother who had glasses that were about an inch thick, and he found that if you put them on and look cross-eyed, he could see through them. So what he did, he went down there one day and he just couldn't see anything, you know. He just said, I can't see anything. And the guy says, well, he says, can you, do you wear glasses? And the guy says, oh yeah, I got glasses. So he pulls out these glasses that are about an inch thick, and he sticks them on, looks cross-eyed, and reads the whole thing. And
so that's how
he said he got it. Another way was, these get some pretty dramatic ways, but they were all given to me as options. One was to shave every piece of hair off your body, just totally. And then when you go into this induction physical, the doctors will look at you, and the minute they want to touch you or something, you just jump back and yell and scream, and you know, they're going to think you're crazy or something. And so they're going to say, well, they'll write this guy off. You'd have to be pretty dramatic, because these doctors are probably seeing everything in the world. Another way was to wash yourself in Ajax and then sleep in a gunny sack. And he said you developed this horrendous rash on your body. And then when the doctor saw this, he says, well, don't you go see a doctor about this? And he said, well, doctors cost money and I don't have any money. You know, that type of thing. So, you know, at this time, the brainstorming of the college students was really rampant, and you could find all sorts of different ways. My father was even approached. There was a man that was working in the same at the University Experimental Farms. He was a professor, actually, who had some connections probably with, well, they said at the time, Communist Party. I'm not sure if that was true, you know, but a lot of people are in different organizations that they say are connected to. And he asked my dad, he says, well, how's Craig doing? Well, he's getting ready to go in the Air Force and this and that. And he goes, well, how does he feel about it? And my dad said, well, I don't think he really enjoys it, but, you know, he knows that he's going to have to do it or, you know, face the consequences, but he's going to do it. And he says, well, if it really bothers him, tell him to come see me because there's ways we can do it, you know. I don't know what that would have been at the time, but there's all sorts of things. Anyway, heading into the Air Force, we go to officers training school down in San Antonio, Texas. Everybody that goes in the Air Force is going to go into San Antonio at one time or the other, Lackland Air Force Base. We flew down there. There was about, I'm sure there must have been 40 of us on this one flight, basically out of Minneapolis, from the whole probably five-state area around North, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. There was about five of us destined to go to officers training school, and the rest of them were going to go through the enlisted basic training at Lackland. Walking down the concourse at San Antonio, there was two or three sergeants standing in the corridor, and they were just picking us out, like, you know, as we come down, and they had us all lined up against the wall. Got us up against the wall in this big group. You know, here starts the, all right, everybody up against the wall, don't talk, you know, all this other crud sometimes. We filled out forms there again, then we all hopped into this bus and drove to Lackland, and they dropped the five of us off at officers training school, which is a Medina annex. It's across the freeway from Lackland, if you're ever interested and want to observe that area. When I arrived there, we got off the bus, Grand bus, and we were met by an officer trainee, which was a guy that had arrived maybe 6 weeks prior to us, so he was an upperclassman. We were taken in, and it was a real nice evening. This was like 9, 10 o'clock at night. We spent a night in one building, and then the next morning we were moved to another building into our squadrons. Officers training school is an interesting place, and I've been threatening to turn the Holden Village High School into officers training school for a week just to let them know how lucky they are over here. We were allowed, I think, we arrived in civilian clothes, and we had one extra change of civilian clothes. That's basically all we took with us. After arrival, the next morning, we were formed into flights in our squadrons. There was four flights in each squadron. Basically, the Air Force, well, I was in the lowest unit of organization is like a flight, and then it's a squadron. And you probably have four or five flights in a squadron. Squadron, well, in the real Air Force, it's like, say, 25 pilots will form a squadron, and the associated enlisted people. And then it becomes a wing, like three squadrons in a wing, and then it's an Air Force, a numbered Air Force, which is Europe, Military Airlift Command, Tactical Air Command, etc. That doesn't really matter. We started marching around this base, a small little base. Basically, our teachers for those first few days were people that had been there 6 weeks prior to us. They would come in just like us. We were commonly called rainbows because of our civilian clothes. We were all different colors, and it was really, you know, quite a contrast to the everybody else who's wearing, you know, khaki color uniforms or dressed blue uniforms. We got our haircut, which was for the officers trainees. My hair at the top of my head was probably an inch long, which compared to the people that ended up at Lackland, it was basically like a quarter of an inch long. We were treated much more human. We all had college degrees, and the other guys were treated, you know, more physically. Our basic training, our officers' training, was 90 days, and the people over on the other side, the enlisted guys, they go through 6 weeks. Ours was much more mental and self-inflicted mental type, you know, systems than the physical. That's what was stressed. There was a lot of physical, you know, running and different things like that, but it was really built mentally around you.
You want to explain that just a little bit more?
Sure. Okay, we had a very extensive academics. And, well, if I describe the whole school, it might, you know, kind of what we were up against. The officer's training school is built around the premise that no individual can get through it. In other words, when we're formed into flights, it's going to take the flight to get through together. One person cannot go through and just say, hey, I'm going to just ace this course and, you know, that's that. I don't care about the other guys. But you can't do it by yourself. Somebody else has got to help you and you got to help them. Okay, on the other side, the enlisted guys were doing, they had their drill sergeants that would say, okay, everybody up in obscene language and yelling and screaming at them. Our flight commanders or comm staff, a commissioned officer who was a captain at the time, he would just, you know, drill us. But it was more like, you know, more of a civilized method that he was using on us type thing. We had very extensive academics and very tough academics for, I don't know, it was throughout the whole 90 days, but they were very, very extensive academics. And there was a lot of competition.
Different places. On how the plane works?
No, this isn't anything to do with flying yet. This is basically how the Air Force is run, chain of command, the different types of, you know, how it's all organized together, you know, physical education, you know, a lot of it just blanks. I just blank out. I'd have to really trigger my mind to remember a lot of the academics. But you really studied hard for it. At the same, you know, our rooms were kept just, we walked in our rooms and there was two bunks. Usually there were, I think there at the time there were double bunk beds, but there was just two people in each one. And there was a little book on the table. This little book told you exactly how to keep your room. That little book always had to be grounded to the corners of the desk. In other words, the desk corner is sitting here. The book had to be sitting just so it was exactly flush with it. The bed was made, we didn't do any of this quarter stuff off the beds. The beds were made with normal hospital corners, tightly fitted. One thing that I learned was a dust cover. You folded a blanket in half and you made the bed from the, first you made the lower bed, or the, you know, the bottom blanket that you were underneath. Then you put your pillow down and you folded this other blanket over the top of the pillow to keep the dust off this pillow. And that was also hospital cornered and down. Okay, that edge of that dust cover had to be exactly 24 inches from the bedpost to that edge. And one of the tricks you learned was you didn't do that too tight, because if you did it too tight, by the time they came to inspect it, it would pull back. You know, it wouldn't be at 24 inches. Your underwear had to be, you know, folded in thirds and up exactly. And your little drawer had to be set up with your socks all smiling, you know, folded in and smiling. I'll show you this fold smile socks. Each hanger in the closet, you only had a few things, but there's probably like 6-7 hangers. Each hanger had to be equally spaced. The lock on you had one drawer that was locked. That always had to be set on 4 because it was squadron 4. So, you know, that type of thing. Well, there's just all kinds
of. Why do they have these rules? What?
Okay, it's, I think.
You're ridiculous.
Well, they were ridiculous, but it was what they needed to get us to do, I guess. To form a military type system, that is one of the basic premises. First, you're going to break down your individuality to some extent to learn that you are going to have to cooperate with all the others to get through, and that it just develops discipline. Later on, when I started flying high performance aircraft, that discipline, the same discipline, came into being. You know, and I don't know how much of it is tradition. I just can't see that place operating without doing like that.
and having the same results, whether those results are bad or good. Every morning you'd wake up at 5:30 in the morning to this trumpet in the hallway, and he'd be sounding reveille, and I still remember he'd give this call and say, "Gentlemen, the time is 5:30. This is the 66th day of training for the upper class and only the 6th day of training for the lower class." And you just went, "Oh, what am I doing here?" Because, okay, that's the 6th day of training, so you got 84 days left. We were commonly known, even outside the Air Force, or among the regular Air Force, as 90-day wonders. We came in as a college graduate and we left as a commissioned officer in 90 days, where an ROTC guy has 4 years of it. There's only three ways to get a commission in the Air Force. One is through ROTC, one is through Officers Training School, and one is through the Air Force Academy. That's one of those three methods you'll go through. One of the trick that we learned, you know, we're spit polishing shoes and everything, but the last guy out of our room, we'd be in stock and feet, of course. But you'd take a flash, shut off the lights, and it's still dark up, take a flashlight, and you get down on the floor, and you just sweep the beam across the floor. And any particle of dust would show up like that, and you just get it with a cloth with a pledge on it or something like that. So we ended up doing this the first, you know, couple weeks. This is really bad. And the first, you know, few days we'd get gigs, and gig was, you know, a demerit type thing. And you'd come back into your room and hear, you know, 20 gigs, and you're, "Oh, great." But pretty soon you started learning little tricks. One of the things I did was my towels had to be set just exactly so, you know, grounded at the bottom. And you start out with towels just like we have here, you know, it's hard to get them just perfectly straight underneath there. But you'd spray a little starch on them and you'd leave them there. My towels stayed there for like 80 days. Well, I'd have another pair and I'd either put them in my dirty clothes bag or something. Our dirty clothes bag was at the end of the bed, and it's a regular laundry bag, you know, like cloth bag about like this, like a pillowcase type thing. But, you know, you just didn't tie it to the end of the bed. You ironed it, starched it, and folded it 13 times. If you ever try to start from one end of, a pillowcase type thing, and fold it exactly so far so you end up exactly with 13 folds, and you do it 3 or 4 times, and then you hope you get it right. And then you had to wrap that around the railing on the bed and wrap it with 13 cords around, and then pull it back through. Well, what I did was my drawer with my t-shirts and things was set up and basically didn't move. What I did was have like two or three pair of t-shirts and underwear in my dirty clothes bag, and I just kind of rotated in there. And so when I got back to the dirty stuff, I'd throw it in the washer, get it out, and put it back in my dirty clothes bag. Because I wasn't going to sit and fold all that stuff all the time. Of course, if I'd gotten caught with clean clothes in my dirty clothes bag, that would have been really bad.
You didn't have fold stuff
that
went into the dirty clothes bag?
No. You learn to sleep at night. You'd sleep, slide underneath the covers. You'd get in trouble if you got caught sleeping on top of your blanket, too. So you learn to slide under your covers and just go to sleep and wake up, and I was in the same position, and then slide out. And you just tuck it in a little bit, and you'd be all set. So, like, after 3 weeks or so, it's set up in 4 groups of 3 weeks. It's officer trainees, and well, you got the upper 6, so it's basically a 4-year program, except that each year is 3 weeks. and by the end of the first 3 weeks, you're getting you're getting to know a few things around it. Okay, when we went to our academics, we marched the whole time to different places. We marched in flights. The first 3 weeks, we could never go any place without having 4 people, and then one of us had to march the other. This was really hard for me, and for some reason, we had about 3 people who were prior service, which meant that they had been in the military before as enlisted people, and now had gotten a chance to go to officer training school, and they were going to upgrade themselves to commissioned officer. When they went there, so those guys had kind of knew what was happening a little bit, and so the first few days, they would march us around. You know, they took, each day you were in charge of the flight. And so they marched around. Well, the first day that they ran out of prior service guys, I got picked. And so I said, well, here goes. And so here I am. First thing you do is you get everybody to go to breakfast. I think I had taken to the first class or something. So you get everybody out in the hallway. Okay, everybody jumps pretty fast. And so you get them out, get them lined up. Everybody's at attention, and you start marching down the sidewalk. Well, I was concentrating really hard on getting these guys going down the sidewalk. So, because, I mean, this is, you see movies, you hear, you know, about a whole flight walking into the side of a building. Well, they'll do that if you don't turn them. Because it's just, you just, you don't turn unless somebody tells you to turn. You just can't do it.
Do you have any brains?
Well, Ben, it's...
Air Force becomes your brain.
Yeah. You're not paid to think. You're paid to do what you're supposed to do, is what they're telling you during this time. And so, what I really blew it was, there was a commissioned officer, in other words, a guy that was already commissioned, he was a captain, okay? And I took my flight, and I should have been saluting for him, and I was concentrating on him, and I just walked right past this guy without saluting. And oh, did I get chewed up and down. And I finally got the whole flight through the day and got it back, and my flight commander, who was a captain, just called me aside and said, Swenson, I don't know if you're ever going to make this. And I said, well, I guess that's a nice vacation. 3 weeks down in sunny Texas or whatever. So we finally made it through. But talking about precision, you had to have your flight. If your flight was scheduled to eat at 12 or 6:25 in the morning, you had to be there at 6:20. Couldn't be any earlier than 6:24 and no later than 6:26. And we were marching like, well, probably equivalent of about four blocks. And, you know, sometimes things would hold you up. And so you had your flight, you know, worked out that they would, you'd kind of slow them down just a little bit, or you'd kind of stop and wait for your watch to catch up to them and then get them in there. But oh, you know, you walked up to the guy and said, you know, you reported to him and said, Squadron 4, flight number 11, reporting for breakfast. And he'd go, he'd look at his watch and, okay, you know, and if you were outside that 2 minutes, the whole flight didn't eat. And when you were eating, during those first 3 weeks, you would always, you'd get in line at attention. Once you were standing still, you came to parade rest. You know, you'd be at attention like that, and then you could go like that. Okay, now the guy in front of you moves, so you get ready to move up. So you had to come forward, and then you march forward one, and then you go back to parade rest. And there were upperclassmen, in other words, guys that had been there for 6 weeks, who were walking around watching for all this stuff to make sure we did it all right. Once you got your meal, they were really pretty decent cafeteria meals. There were tables of four. When you took your meal, this was for the first 3 weeks, you took it back to the table, you set it down, so one edge of the tray was right even with the edge of the table, another edge of the tray was even with the edge of the table, feet flat on the floor, you looked at your tray and you ate. You didn't look up, you didn't look around, you didn't talk. When you got done, you picked up your tray, took it back, went outside, and the flight formed up outside and marched away. The second 3 weeks, you could look up and be a little more relaxed. The last 6 weeks, you could talk. I could go on and on about officers training school. We had, well, one other thing that would be interesting, we had flight DPRs and squadron DPRs, which drill proficiency ratings, where we had a big parade field and we marched all around. You had a set number of maneuvers to go through. First with a flight of, say, about 10 people, and then a squadron of, say 25 to 30 people. And you marched them around being graded the whole time. And I was never so glad, you know, one of our favorite sayings was, well, that's dead. So flight DPRs were dead, squadron DPRs were dead. In other words, they were done for. You didn't have to worry about them anymore. Every Saturday morning was a parade. And these parades, you know, a military march can really get your adrenaline going when you're into it. We'd get out real early in the morning, and Friday night as a lower classman too, you did wedge. In other words, we're going to do it in log six pretty soon. But you take steel wool and you get every black mark off our white tile in the hallways, waxed and buffed the whole building, Venetian blinds. I mean, everything was clean. The toilets, everything. I mean, it was just spotless. And the next morning, you know, you probably use one sink for the whole flight. And then that person, the last guy out, would clean off that sink just perfect again. And then we'd be ready. We'd go outside and we'd form up. Okay, then we'd... The squadron or the whole group's parades were a thing of really precision. You'd have like 200-300 people out there all marching, and you'd march in, march around, and you'd march into like Patton's theme or something like that. So you really got this old adrenaline going around the back. You'd have people in the back, standing in the back, so in case somebody fainted. You learn to stand at attention without your knees locked. If you lock your knees, you can cut off the blood supply and faint on you.
Craig, what were you feeling and thinking going from easy college days of relaxation and free weekends and free evenings to the very strict, almost absurd living conditions?
The thing that probably kept us going was a lot of times you didn't think you were going to make it and you just kind of gave up. But then everybody was there voluntarily. And the choice I had between, you know, it got to be a challenge. You said, well, those suckers aren't going to get me, and so I'm going to get it. You know, you got to be that type of a feeling. You don't, my alternative was become a draft dodger and go to jail or whatever, or end up as an enlisted guy in the trenches. You know, and people were fighting to get out of that. I was in a very enviable position for that slot I had.
When was the first time you had time? Free time ever?
Okay, usually the first two or three weekends you were just gigged in, you couldn't do anything. After that, as you got to be, so you didn't have like over four mistakes per week, you would end up, and pretty soon you were so good at it that you probably, might slip one or two. But then you could go to the officers' training club, OT club, which that was on Friday nights. And you go up there and you could have a steak dinner and you could, just have a great time. Commissioned officers had to be invited to come up there, and they would beg to be invited because it was a good place to go. That was the time that you could kind of let up, yet you were still in your uniform. Towards the later parts, the last 6 weeks, usually Saturday afternoons, from the parade Saturday, say at noon, you could leave base and go into San Antonio, but you'd have to be back Sunday at noon. So you basically had 24 hours. I never spent a night away from, we'd go out and goof around that afternoon or something. We were still in uniform though the whole time. We went downtown San Antonio, we were in uniform. So basically for 90 days, and that was one of the strangest things, was after 90 days we had a party over at our flight commander's house, who was basically our teacher and let us through. After, we were just ready to get commissioned. And he says, well, why don't you guys come over in civilian clothes? So we went up into this one room of our squadron, and we all dug out our clothes, and they were moldy and all this stuff. Because we hadn't seen them for 90 days. And we put them on, and if you've seen somebody in a uniform for 90 days, and all of a sudden they put on a blue jeans and a sweater or something, you go, whoa, do you look different? And it was really a shock to see that. Then even like doing the parade, halfway through the parade, we put on white gloves. And then during the different maneuvers of the parade, you'd be saluting, and there'd be people standing in the stands. In fact, their upperclassmen would watch. If you got a flight, say, of 100, or a squadron of, say, 100 people, all saluting at exactly the same moment, if with white gloves on. If you didn't have your salute exactly timed, there's a little ripple effect, and you get marked down on it. What they wanted was one movement up and one movement down.
Did you ever, as an upperclassman, check other people?
Yeah, I had one opportunity. It was kind of interesting. That morning when everybody else went to parade, I went on wedge. Okay, we were a team of four. We were selected. And what we did was, we marched in a diamond formation up to the other group. And so when we turned a corner, we're in a diamond formation. This guy's leading it. Well, there's one guy in command. But like when we turned and went this way, all four of us would just turn like this. So now this guy is a leader. And if I went like this, then so when we moved around, our diamond same in exact same position, except it headed in different directions. That was just how we marched up there for some reason. We went into this one squadron building that we were supposed to inspect. We had 15 seconds for gross calls. In other words, we marched into this room in the same diamond formation, all facing different direction, and this guy had a watch from that squadron. He'd say, okay, go. And we had 15 seconds just to look around that room and say, you know, this. One of the things was pledge on the floor. If you use pledge on the floor, it gets real slippery, real shiny and beautiful, but it gets real slippery. And so you could feel that when you walked in. After those 15 seconds, like you could say, dust on the floor, you know, and you just called out those different things. Then each of us had a specific thing that we were supposed to inspect. Okay, for this group, they had their PE shorts and shirts hung on a rack, on hangers that were on a rack. So there's a towel rack with these two hangers on. Okay. I had a ruler, and I inspected, when it was my time to inspect, I ran over there, and I measured to make sure that those three intervals were exactly equal. And if they weren't, I called it off, and then, you know, they would put a mark on it. And there was just a big competition to the whole thing.
Did you get anything out of that?
Okay, Beth, here's something that I do today, and I don't have the right shirt on now. It was called a gig line. Like, well, John, if you have your shirt on, here.
Yeah. Front center, John.
Okay, you see this line right here where his flap flips over? And that comes down, and we'll wear a square belt buckle, goes to the square belt buckle, and just fly. That line's perfectly straight.
And good job!
And so, and to this day, when I put on a shirt and a belt and my pants, I line that up.
See what
I
got out of it?
Yeah. That's how I got out of it. One of the first things, you know, when you buy new clothes, you know, there's threads and stuff hanging out. When we got issued our clothes, we probably spent a half a day with fingernail clippers clipping those threads off. You know, the loose threads. They're called cables. We carried masking tape on our, we had a thin billfold, plastic billfold that we carry, with just our ID card in it and a couple gig slips. In case you got in trouble, you had to have a gig slip the guy could write you up on. And on the back of that, we put two or three strips of masking tape. Okay, when we got ready, just before class, just before our commissioned officer inspected us, we had spit polish shoes and the whole works, but we had shoulder boards that were kind of fuzzy, and once in a while a little lint would get on it. So what you do, you'd take this masking tape and you just stick it on this your friend's, whoever was next to you, shoulder boards, and it just picks up all that little lint. That type of stuff. You learn to be very, very sharp dressers. I mean, nothing was out of place. If you had a button, it was buttoned, except for the top of the shirt. You didn't have to button unless it was in there. If you ever noticed, think up in Arnie's room, there's an Air Force cap. There's little buttons on it with eagles on it. Those eagles stay upright. You don't twist them over on the side. There's a band on it, and if you put the band, the visor's black, and then the band can slip up or down, but you put it tight, so it's black, and then there's a little bit of blue showing, and then the black. I can't say I got anything out of it, except really being particular for, you know, little things. And probably learning how to cooperate with other people. Because there's no way you could do it by yourself. You became a very close-knit group. that helped one another. Nobody, it wasn't one of these things where, well, if I don't do it, somebody else will do it. Everybody did it because everybody had to work hard to do it all that we needed to do.
Great.
Yeah.
Are you saying that the basic training for like Army or enlisted was more, when you said more physical, more push-ups and less academic, but uh-huh. was it more guff than you got, more abuse?
Our abuse was somebody standing in your face just giving it to you.
Yeah.
You know, just raising you up and down. But it wasn't, okay, do 50 push-ups in front of me. It was, they really worked on our mental, our mind, much more than our physical body. But what I did, we had to run a mile and a half, and by the end of that 90 days, I was probably in the best shape I had ever been in. We ran it in, I ran it in under 9 minutes that time, which felt neat. I also was on the Roadrunner program type thing, where, and it was our one escape, was that you could go out and run up to 3 miles a day at mile and a half intervals. And I started doing that, and I ran over 144 miles in those months. But that was the time where you could, you know, in the first 3 weeks you had to get somebody to go with you. But after that, you could march out, you still marched, but you marched by yourself, and you ran this thing. So here you got, you know, 10, 15 minutes all by yourself, just getting yourself physically tired as you can. You just kept just trucking along. I really use that.
Can you talk about the philosophy of war, or what you were being trained to do, and what kind of mental...
We learned a lot about command situations, the equipment of the Air Force, the planes. It wasn't... I wish I could go back and look. I have some of my books someplace. So you could see exactly what we did learn, but it wasn't really hardcore war fighting situation. That came later. What they were basically doing was trying to mold you into somebody that can absorb that. Talking about physical things and things that they had thought of to do was, one of the things we played as a team sport was, in fact almost all the time, was flickerball, which is a combination of football, basketball, soccer, hockey. That's about it. It's everything all in one different thing with lots and lots of different rules. And what their premise was, hey, yeah, somebody might come here and be really good at football. Somebody might come here and be really good at soccer. But when you start playing this game, you're all starting equal because nobody, you know, with the different rules and things that, if you're good at one thing or the other, it just won't help you a lot. At the end of officers' training school, they talked about, well, you know, you're supposed to throw your hat in the air when you do it. And I said, oh, that's a bunch of bull. I'll never do that. Boy, I sure did. When you're out at the parade field, and this time it's your parade for graduation. And what they do is they say, they give the commissioning thing, and they say, officers dismissed. And then you just take your hat. And I threw it up as high as I could, and it came right back down in my arms again. So I didn't have to go running around looking for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You sort of kind of partially answered my question a few minutes ago when you were talking about working together and doing, you know, learning how to be a unit or something. But I presumably all of that nonsense garbage that sounds really ridiculous is done for a purpose, and maybe over, you know, to an extreme. But what do you consider that the goals were of the trainers? And do you think it was effective? And do you think that there are other ways of doing that that might be just as effective or more effective? That's kind of a loaded question.
Yeah. Let's see. I think what their goal was is to produce a person that can follow directions, maybe without asking questions a lot of times.
Or that will follow directions.
Yes. That will, I mean, you're following a little tiny direction. Also a person that works well with others, you know, and understands that he needs others to work with. It you can't do it as an individual.
And you think that's an effective way of doing it?
It's a very effective way of doing it. And it's a quick way of doing it. I think it's a quicker way of doing it than any other way. I've thought about this with different situations. I mean, what was it that I said, yeah, sure, I'm going to sit down here and take steel wool on this little tile and get it clean with that little black mark? You know, what? How come I did that? I mean, that sounds... And if I will tell Gary to do that, he'll just tell me to jump in the lake. And why did I do it? And I guess everybody that was there wanted to be there. We weren't being forced into it. Nobody got drafted. And you could get out of that. But if you got out of it, you know, where do you go from there? Type thing. So, yeah, you know, is there an easy way to do it? I don't know. I'm sure there is. But for that number of people they were putting through and what they wanted, I don't know if it would be effective or efficient way to do it.
There are a couple of articles in this month's Atlantic that I just got that have to do with the draft. Mm-hmm. I just started reading the first one, and when I finish, I'll bring them over to the dining hall.
Oh, good.
But the one I'm reading now is the guy's premise is that there's no, you know, the discipline and the ability to work as a unit and our trained force is just getting worse and worse. And, I'm going to finish the article. I'll bring it over. Some of you might be interested in reading both of those.
I'll say a little bit about that right now is that when we don't have the draft, I mean, I would probably, if I hadn't been faced with the draft, more than likely I would not have been in the military.
What did you say?
If I hadn't been faced with the draft, when I graduated from college, it was either the draft...
You wouldn't have joined the Air Force as an option after college if it wasn't the alternative.
No. Right. And I think they talk about the quality of the military going downhill, and I think that's true. Because even with the draft, you know, people that, you're getting more cross-section of people affected. In other words, it's not just the people that can't get a job on the outside and say, hey, well, I guess I'll go in the military because I can't do anything else, and maybe that'll teach me something, or something like that. It's not just people like that. You're getting people that, yeah, I can do other things, but boy, I don't have a choice. I got to do something, you know. And so then you're forcing probably a higher caliber of person that probably wouldn't normally be in the military into the military, and they're accepting that.
Did you have any of your group that fought that kind of, that was just an individualist and stubborn and said, that's nonsense? And wouldn't do it, or did you have
any? Not after like 2 or 3 days. I mean, I probably can't really express it. They had ways of just, you know, without beating it out of you, just saying, hey, and you just felt, whoa, I gotta do it, or I'm, you know, type of thing. If I don't, well, then it's really gonna be a sad situation. Yeah?
How did they sort of condition you in case? What did they do, you know, in case that, I don't know how to ask this. If you were ever caught and were a POW, did they train you ahead of time for what the enemy would do?
Yeah, it's quite a long story. I don't know if I have time. I would like to go through the rest of this stuff and probably do that some other time, along with some flying things, if somebody would like to do that. But if you want to hear that now, I'll start talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, after pilot training, I went through 3 survival schools. All air crew members, pilots, go through 3 different survival schools. Actually, 2. I went through the 3rd. One was water survival down in Homestead, Florida. I was there in June, and it was 4 days course that we parasailed in Key Biscayne Bay. We spent an hour in a one-man life raft to Key Biscayne Bay with black socks over our tennis shoes so the sharks wouldn't bite you.
Oh, nice.
And it was like a vacation, along with a lot of academics. Especially coming out of pilot training, you know, it was like a vacation. When I also went to Arctic survival, but that was much later in Alaska. But the main survival school is a 2-week course taught at Fairchild Air Force Base, Spokane, Washington. So I knew... You're not supposed to know a lot of what's going to happen to you there. But basically what it's billed at is a mountain survival course where, you know, you bail out over the mountains and you're going to have to learn how to survive. And what you're expecting is something a lot like what you come up, you know, they do up here over Thanksgiving. you know, how do you survive in winter, and what can you do here and there? Well, in actuality, it's a lot of the academics and almost every a lot of the exercises are very tailored to escape and evasion. And escape and evasion, basically what you're doing, you've been shot down over enemy territory. And also, or and to survive under those conditions, and also POW training. What we did was, first we went through a lot of academics, just the basic survival techniques. Then we started going into, well, you take off and you're carrying codes, of course, all the times. So you're carrying a safe letter. Like when you do get shot down, you try to make it to a safe area that you've memorized on a map. And to simulate this, one of the things we did was go on a trek in what's up by Colville, north of Spokane a ways. And we had made packs out of parachute material, different things. So everything we had was basically like if we had, you know, ejected out of a fighter, come down and sat down for a day, you know, and fixed our stuff up and started hiking around trying to get out. But first, we spent like a day with the instructor. We had two cans of sea rations, combat rations, which basically are survival food, except when you're in combat conditions, the Army uses them a lot. And I used them a lot with the Army when I was in Europe. They also gave us, it's like one potato each, a couple carrots, an onion, and a little bit of meat. First night we used some of the meat to put it, made into a stew, and also dried some and smoked a bunch, so we took that with us. Well, you know, it wasn't much, it's just like a quarter pound per person or something. We built a shelter with the instructor that first day. We did some night navigation by compass, going from place to place. And then the next day they gave us a point on a map that was probably 8-10 miles distance away, and we had to find that point. It started raining and it was cold, but this school runs year round. In other words, it also runs during the middle of the winter when they wear snowshoes and two sleeping bags. And I was there in May when it was raining and cold, but we had one sleeping bag and we could walk on the ground. And so I was really happy to get my A7 training right after my pilot training. So instead of going in December, I ended up going into May, which was a good situation for me. I was just lucky. So we found this point, and basically what we're doing here is simulating finding ourselves in enemy territory, going cross country with a group, and making contact with the underground, the friendly people in the area. When we arrived at the point, we set up camp again, and we still haven't made any contacts. But, you know, our tent was just a tarp. And it's basically very, just, we really used what we would have had with us, type of thing. We were also taught an interesting thing that if we did bail out over enemy territory in a combat environment, if you can get by without stealing anything, don't steal anything. Once, like if I steal an apple from a tree or kill somebody's chicken to eat, no longer do I come under the Geneva Conventions. Now I'm a criminal that can be tried by the country's laws, which is a bad situation to get in. You know, war is war, and you're not going to, I'm sure they're not going to have a good time and say, well, yeah, under Geneva Convention, because you haven't done anything. But that was one of the things they told us. You know, if you steal something, be ready to, you know, accept the consequences of being tried under a criminal law of that country. And in other words, you're kind of removing the United States government from that situation. So the next day we traveled again as a flight, again cross country, about 10 miles. And, you know, we crossed clear cut areas. It was real rough going. I mean, just compass and topographical maps, that's what we had. And it took us most of the day, and we had instructions to get to this point. They described the point. When you get to this point, everybody hide. Okay? Shortly after you get there, you know, at a certain time, a man will approach the area that you're hiding in, and he'll have a black arm around his left arm. You walk up and say, you know, beautiful sunny weather today. And you say, Why do you say that? It's raining. And that was your clue that, yeah, this is the guy you want. And you say, hey, we're here. And the guy says, how many are there? And you say, 10. And he says, okay, stay here for the night. I'll bring you instructions in the morning. So we stayed there that night. The next morning he brought instructions to go to another point, except this time we split up in pairs of two. And the way they split us up was, well, we had a 47-year-old colonel with us, one of us, you know, just a real range of people in our flight. And they put a real strong person with a real weak person. In other words, this guy is just barely making it over the hills, and they put a real strong person with him, and you'd make it together. But then we split up in twos and traveled to this next point. And at the same time, you have instructors out in the woods looking for you, see if they can find you. If they find you, they'll take you back and start you over. When we were when we got to this next point, we were again approached, you know, hiding, and got approached by another guy. He took us to another camp, and this was a well-maintained camp. Here they took our fingerprints, and it was actually being like a prisoner in this underground camp. And the reason they said that this is probably going to happen to you is because these people are risking their lives for you. And if they get caught helping you guys, you know, it's their head as well as yours. And so they're just, you do exactly what those guys tell you. You know, how do you know when you're in the right position with the right people? You know, you got to trust somebody. But, you know, they treated us pretty rotten. They took our fingerprints, sent them in, and confirmed that, yeah, these guys are the guys that they say they are. And we got food in garbage cans, you know, over a fire, you know, some stew of some sort, you know, maybe 1 out of 10 person got a piece of meat. You'd stand guard, and you'd had to stay in certain areas and different things. I will have whittled a knife, fork, and spoon on that out. The next day, we again split up in twos, and we had to make it to two intermediate points. And this time, I was with this colonel, and we're basically traveling straight lines. You never went on any paths or any roads because you'd get caught, sure as heck. And we were getting close to the final point, and we were coming down this hill, making quite a bit of noise. And all of a sudden, I looked down, and underneath the undergrowth, way down below, I could see some feet. And we just dropped right there in the woods, high up in the cliff there. And the guy walks around in front of him, and he gets down, and he kind of looks back up underneath the trees, and he says, why don't you guys come down? And so I figured, well, here, I'll go down and talk to him. So I got up and went down, and I just, you know, motioned for the other guy just to stay there. So we talked for a while, and he says, well, why don't you have your other guy come down too? And it was one of the instructors, and we had been making too much noise because he caught us. But he said, well, I know that you guys did the right thing, when you saw me, you guys just flattened, didn't make any noise. If we hadn't done that, then he'd probably taken us way back to 8 miles back to the starting point. We'd have to start all over and trying to get there. And then he asked us, well, where are you and where's the point? And we said, well, the point's right around the corner up here. So we knew exactly where we were. We got to that point. We again spent another night in a camp. And the next morning, they helicoptered us out. And that was kind of our survival thing. Okay, that was... I got another story about another section of that camp if you want to hear it real quick before coming.
Yeah.
Okay, this one, I'll go through the trek anytime again, but I won't go through this next section again if I can help it. We were told that we would expect to be captured. This was back on Fairchild Air Force Base again, way off in the corner somewhere. We will expect to be captured and spend some time as a prisoner. Try to smuggle in different ways. We got trained in different ways of using interrogation ways to get around interrogation and everything. So one night about midnight, they had us all there, and I had gum in my clothes, and I had thumbtacks under my boots, and a candy bar here, a couple bottles of water, a couple three candy bars, and I had, you know, the seams of my shirt had dentine gum in it, you know, it was all just a big game that we were going to do. And at midnight we started a mile and a half obstacle course that was set up in an L shape with barbed wire, wooden barricades, ditches, and also trip wires that set off magnesium flares. So for this mile and a half, you're crawling around and you have a stick and you're going under this concentrated barbed wire, you know, with a stick over your head, going underneath it and then go down a ditch and climbing over posts and stuff, and there's searchlights going around out there. And what you do is, all the time in front of you, you're making a figure eight with a stick, and you're crawling this whole time. With that figure eight, you'll come through this figure eight, and all of a sudden you'll hit a little wire, and you tap it a little bit, and you're like, ooh. And that's one of those tripwires, and then so you get under this tripwire. Once in a while, somebody will hit one of those things without knowing it, and it's like setting off a mine or something, except the flare goes off, and then everybody lays flat. You're trying to hide. And if they see you moving at all during that flare, they'll take you back to start. So I took my time, probably took me an hour and a half, 2 hours to get through. So this is probably around 2 o'clock in the morning. And so I'm expecting to get caught at this other end. And I'm in this last ditch, and it's about 100 meters to the one spot where they're gonna capture us. And so I lay there, and with the baby bottles that we use for water bottles at the time. And then they collect them and give them to an orphanage or something. So it's for a good cause. So I drank my water and ate a couple candy bars, and I sat there and I watched people going in to get caught. It was a one light. And then I finally says, well, I guess I better do it. So I walked in, and they see me coming, and right away, this is where it starts getting rough. Very abusive language. Not rough physically, other than shoving you around a little bit. We were told that you could yell for a doctor all you want, and you're not going to get anything. But if you yell for a flight surgeon, that's the one clue that said, yeah, okay, this guy's really sick and he needs help. So that was the one word that you could say that would get you out of it. You still had to go through this before you became a pilot in the Air Force, or you had to go through it. And so everybody wanted to get it over with. And you didn't want to go halfway through it and then have to start all over again. Well, so it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and as we come in, we're lined up, and you get this dirty old laundry bag over your head. It's smelly, maybe some holes in it, but nothing much. And you're standing with your arms on the guy in front of you like this. And they're just, you know, abusive language, and they're yelling and screaming at you. If they find anything on you, like a big bulge of candy or something, they grab it and throw it away, and yell and say, what are you doing with that pig and animal and things like this. So I didn't really know these guys, even see them. So when they get about 10 of you together, they march you along. They say, okay, they throw a rag to the front guy and says, hang on to this and follow me. And everybody's stomping their left foot, and you're going, just marching like that. And they wander all over creation, I think. And pretty soon you end up in this one dugout. And so you hear yourself hitting on cement and the light gets, and they stop you there. And they said, and there's like five cells on a side. And the first thing they do is they put you in these cells, open up the doors, and they say, okay, go in your cell and throw all your clothes out. So you go in your cell and you're sitting there, and I'd say it's 5 feet tall by 4 feet by 4 feet. And so the door's still open, and you throw all your clothes out in the hall, or it's a big open area outside. And so then what you do is you stand in the back, so you turn your back to the opening, and then you have your one hand in each corner of the ceiling and one foot in each corner of the floor. So you're standing there just spread eagle, and then they come by, search your body to make sure you're not trying to sneak anything in, and search your clothes, and then they throw all your clothes in and slam the door shut. And you got a number 10 can in the cell just to go to the bathroom or whatever you want. And so that now you're in solitary confinement. They tell you to stand in the center facing out. Okay, that's what they tell you. I knew a little bit this was going to happen. So the one guy told me, try to smuggle in some thumbtacks, and you can thumbtack this dirty old laundry sack to the ceiling. And then when he slips open the slide door to look in, you'll see this dirty old laundry sack and think you're standing straight up. Well, that didn't work too good for me, so what I would usually do, I was kind of in a middle cell, so I'd lay down and just put the sack kind of up on my head and just kind of go to sleep in the corner. And then usually they'd come around checking, and usually the first guy, he'd open up the door and the guy was sleeping, and he'd, you know, just yell and scream and kick him around. And then you wake up and you go, oh, here he comes. So you'd put your laundry sack down and stand up, and you'd be there. this one guard we had would sit outside, and he was tooling leather this whole time. He'd go tap, 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 tap. And this one guy across the hall, you know, just was in our group of 10, he just kind of went, "Why don't you shut up and quit doing that?" And he goes, "Who said that?" And this guy said, "Number 10. I said, "Okay." So he goes over and gets him out, and he makes him stand in front of his little table while he goes tap, 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 tap. This went on for quite some time, and then they came by, picked you up, and got you outside and marched you around, marched you into this other building somewhere. This is where time loses track. You know, I still went in there about, you know, 2 o'clock that morning. I'm sure I was in there for about 2 days, with three times out. And that was for interrogation. You get into this other building, you still got this dirty old laundry sack over your head, so you don't know where in the heck you are. And when you walk in, there's Soviet style music playing. But this was in 72. Okay, so you're all sitting down around the same. Okay, this is the one thing that I had a tough time with, but I knew it was gonna happen, and I figured I could handle it. What they did was they put us in little black boxes. I did look once, just snuck a look, and I did see that there were black boxes. What you did was you get in, they would push you in head first, and they're like, you get in like this, so your face is just down like that, and you're just like this. And they slam the door shut and squeeze it, it's a squeeze box. So what you learn to do is kind of blow yourself up as big as you could, and then when they got done squeezing, then you'd kind of relax a little bit so you got a little bit of extra space. Then I'd roll up, I'd have my hands here, and I'd roll up this dirty old laundry sack that's starting to get really smelly after a while, and I'd keep my hands in front of my face so I could get some breathing room, and then I'd count. I'd just go 1, 2, and you still hear this music in the background, 3, 4, and I'd usually get up to like 300, 350 before they let you out. And I don't like real tight places, and that was the only way I could do it, was just to count, to keep my mind just going 1, 2. That's all I could think about. A few classes prior to that, one guy just went crazy and busted out of it. You know, it was a plywood box. And so when he let me out, I went, "Oh man, that's over with. Don't have to do that again." Because somebody in my powertrain class said, "Well, you'll have to go into this black box." And I said, "Well, that's all right." Then we went to interrogation rooms. They dropped you off at different interrogation rooms. While you were in these interrogation rooms, a guy would come out and always bring you in. And you'd sit down in a little room, something like the tape library there. It was just a white room, and there'd be a guy in there. And they tried different tactics on you. One guy would just start yelling and screaming at you and say, "You better tell me everything you need to know, or I want to know." He says, "We know you flew A-7s and all this stuff," because they had files on you. These guys wore black uniforms with red stars on their collars. They could only teach or instruct at this basic survival area for 6 weeks, and then they detrained them, and they put a new group in. Because they found that people would be instructing there actually started living their roles at home even. It would just carry through because they just started, you know, treating their families or whatever just the same way. So we were trained to try different tactics at them. One was, I don't remember anything. First thing I remember was I was laying down and you guys came and picked me up. You know, I don't remember anything. And that never worked real good. You know, they always my hands are burned, my hands are burned, you know, and that's all I can think about. I just got burned hands. And then he'd say, "Well, here, hold this," and then you hold it, and he said, "Well, your hands can't be too badly burned if you can hold that." And you go, yeah. These guys were real experts. And, you know, one of the things was they did to a friend of mine. He was in there, and finally the guy says, "Here, just hold this, you know." So he held a paper, "Just hold it in front of you, you know." So he said, "Well, what's wrong with holding it in front of you?" So he held it in front of him. The guy left the room. Came back a couple minutes later, and he had this picture. It was a black and white picture, and it was a Polaroid shot. And here's a picture of my friend holding this thing, except it's a sign that says, on this side, it said, "I kill women and children." Mm-hmm. You know? you fire that off to your hometown newspaper, and here you got a hometown boy standing with a sign saying, "I kill women and children." If the counteraction you were trying to use didn't feel you were doing very well, good job, they would say, look at the sign on the wall, and you'd look at the sign and it said change, and then you'd have to figure out a new way. One of the main ways they did it was you first got in there and one guy would just start, you know, just really almost physically or mentally beating on you, just yelling and screaming at you, and they couldn't hit us and we couldn't hit them, but it got to the point where, you know, you really were ready to do that. They could make you stand with your forehead against the wall or your fingers against the wall, which they did, you know, self-inflicted punishment, but you'd have to do it. So this one guy is doing all this, and all of a sudden this other guy walks in. He goes, wait, what's going on here? You know, we don't want all this hassle, you know, and he says, hey, get out of here, you know, just kicks the other guy out. And then he says, oh, you know, that guy shouldn't have done all this stuff, you know, are you all right, you know, you like a cup of coffee, and it's the old rescue routine. This guy comes in to rescue you, and you say, oh, sure, boy, I couldn't understand why that guy was doing it for me, you know, and the guy says, then he says, well, how are you feeling today? And he says, oh, pretty good, you know. And he says, oh, I bet you really miss your family. And he says, yeah. And he says, how's your wife now, do you think? And she, you know, and pretty soon, if you answer one question, they got, you know, this, it starts snowballing on you. They knew, well, from our records and from other things, they knew family names. I mean, they could use my mom's name, my sister's name, my brother's name. They knew what kind of airplane I had been flying. So it was, the one thing they said don't do is just don't say, my name is Craig Swenson, serial number 476627161, because you're going to get your head blown off. I mean, they just won't monkey with you. So usually you didn't know enough that it would probably, what you could do is make up things and try to make them believe it. But they never taught us to not tell the truth if it was going to kill you. You know, that's up to your own personal decision. So we went through three interrogations like that. The one thing that I had a hard time with was because every time we'd go back into solitary and then we'd go back to interrogation, they put me back in that black box every time. And that was tough for me. The first time I figured, well, I was psyched up, so I can hack it this first time. The second and third times, especially the second time, I said, wait a minute, they're not supposed to do this to me again. One time they took us all out of the box, and they put us up against the wall and just left us there. And pretty soon it's quiet, and you just hear this music, and I was just sitting there, I guess I was chicken, but some of the other guys started, you know, lifting up their, you know, the bag over their head and started looking around saying, hey, what's going on here? And, you know, I said, oh, there's what the black boxes look like. Oh, this doesn't look so bad out here. Well, 5 minutes later, they come barging back in, and they've been sitting in a one-way mirror there, and they took those guys and shoved them right in the black box again. You know? I mean, so we did that. I don't know how long we spent solitary. We would get fed, like, once a day, and it was a little trap door in the bottom of our cell, and you get pushed in, and it was a can with some watery type stew in it, you know, real, just what you'd expect, you know. It tasted all right, but I don't know what it was. Then we were moved into a compound, which is, if you've seen Stalag 13, this is a Stalag 13, I mean, complete with barbed wire, the towers, different things like this. So now we're back into a large group again, and we had the commanding, or the ranking officer was always the commanding officer. That's part of the chain of command, part of the thing you learn, is that you don't worry about who's going to be in charge, because the ranking officer is also always going to be in charge. Well, they also told us, in one of, they call an academic situation, it's okay, this is what you should have done. And then you go right back into, you know, you're back in prison again. But they said, okay, one of your people is going to be an informer. So they picked a couple of our people and said, okay, here's part of the game. Part of the game is you're going to tell us everything that you hear. Everything. And you go, oh, great. So And they wanted us to plan escapes, but you had to have an escape chip to leave, to do an escape. So at night we had, you know, when we'd have air raids go off and they'd have recordings with bombings and machine guns and lights go out, and person lights go out and one guy's halfway out the gate, you know, or somewhere underneath the fence, and he gets caught. We had, but so this escape chip got passed around. And, well, even in solitary, we used a lot of communication tapping, but they'd use it to catch us at it. But we were trained in communication, too. And basically all we were doing was what prisoners that had come back from Vietnam and said, this is what had happened to us, or what they found out. And it was really, what we went through was kind of what they were going through in Vietnam. So we had one guy escape, and he got way back to the thing, and they finally found him and hauled him back in. But there were times when there was a little box that I got thrown in. One of the punishments that I really had a hard time dealing with was the commandant was up in front, you know, and so we were all supposed to bow to the commandant. Oh, and a Soviet flag was flying over this this camp, and the commandant was, we were all supposed to bow, so some of us, we aren't going to bow. So we're standing there, not going to bow. Pretty soon, the guy says, hey, bow, you know, and they're yelling and screaming at us. I won't use all the language. And they say, okay, if you're not going to bow, so your buddy's standing right next to you, and he's bowed, you know, just real nice. And they say, come here. They take your buddy and shove him in a little box. And they say, okay, bow. And you don't bow. Say, they don't punish you. They punish the guy next to you. You know, the guy that's doing the right thing. And it's much easier to accept punishment for yourself because of what you're doing, but to see somebody being punished for your actions, that's tough. At least it was for me. So finally you say, well, what the heck, you know, I might as well bow, or does that hurt, you know? But I got put in a little box in the ground with water in it like this, and it was locked at the top, you know, and it was about this high, and I was crunched down. Again, Prada doesn't like small little places. And they slam a lock in the front, and you know that, I can't get out of here when I want. I was probably down there for 4 or 5 minutes. But another one was called a doghouse. It was kind of a cage with bones in the bottom of it, about this high. And they shoved about as many people in there as they could get. And if you're sitting with your knees on bones and all this other stuff, it gets kind of tiring after a while. Stocks, big guys in stocks. One night we were ready to eat, and they said, okay, everybody's going to eat except these guys because they've been misbehaving or something. And we said, hey, I'm not going to, you know, none of us are going to eat if those guys can't eat. And what it was a garbage can unit filled with tea, one of them, and a garbage can filled with a rice. And there were actually, I think it was like sardines or something in there, so there was fish heads and stuff in there. It didn't smell that bad. And he said, no, we're not going to do it. And the guy says, oh, you're not going to do it, huh? He just goes, just knocks them over on the floor, you know, on the dirt. And they're just laying out in the dirt. So nobody ate. They call us in later and says, you should have eaten to keep your guys' strength up. You know, it wasn't going to make any difference if the other guys, you know, they just called our bluff and they just said, oh, okay, no biggie. What do we care? So this was going on for another day or so. One of the things that they had me do, and it was really a neat experience, actually, what it worked out was I was supposed to go mop these dugouts, and it was kind of a bunker filled with rocks in the bottom, and then there was kind of cement walls. And he said, go down there, mop it, and it's like mopping dirt floors, you know, and you know, well, that's kind of crazy. But what the heck, you know, I haven't got anything better to do. So I take this mop pail, and I go down there, and I'm sitting there mopping. And of course, this is like the third or fourth day, and I'm getting tired, and then you don't eat very much at all. And so your body starts, your mind starts doing things. So I've never had an experience like this, and people are going to think I'm crazy. But I was hallucinating. And once in solitary, I saw horses run by just like television. But this was so real that I was sitting mopping, and all of a sudden the water flowed out of this mop pail. But it really didn't. And it flowed across the ground, and all this wheat field grew up. And I was standing in the bottom of this dugout in this wheat field. And the wheat was just blowing in the wind, you know, just like in front of myself. I thought, wow, that's pretty. And then a little bit later, that just disappeared. And then, just a little bit after that, I'm sitting there with my mop, The whole dugout, it's real dark in there. I could just barely make out things. The whole dugout just filled up with butterflies. Except it wasn't just ordinary butterflies. They were all different sizes, and they were translucent purple with translucent yellow around the wingtips, around the edges of the wings. And they were just all fluttering all over the place. And they had told us that, you know, something like that might happen to you. And then the next morning, as the sun was coming up, I think by this time we knew our time was about up. And so, I mean, this is only like 4 or 5 days long. And so, but after this long, you're kind of wondering, you know, hey, I wish somebody would tell me that this is a game, because, you know, they're playing it to the hilt. And so we're up from the commandant early that morning, the sun's coming up, and what they do is so you're standing there at attention, and you're just standing there kind of. And they say, you know, Squadron 10 hot for the commandant, and he comes up and stands there, and he says, all right, about face. So everybody kind of just goes and turns around. As you start turning around, they play a Star Spangled Banner, and they're raising the American flag over the compound. And that's the end. But it's, you know, you go, wow, it's really neat that it wasn't there. You know, people were very emotional at that point to see the American flag. But that's basically just the one POW training. What they did it for us so that when we, not for a lot of hassle maybe, even though I don't know, you know, it was a lot of hassle, but as an air crew member flying over enemy territory, you could easily end up in that situation, and you're probably going to end up in worse situations, but at least you're going to know how you're going to react some way. And so when you start hallucinating, when you're under these stressful conditions, it's not a surprise to you.